Judges 12, this follows on the final part of the life of Jephthah. I want to just observe that the judges were raised up by God and used by God, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were righteous or spiritual. There's quite a few hints that a lot of them had a lot of weakness, and yet God still used them. God used the Assyrians. They were, according to Isaiah 10, the tool, the instrument in his hand. There are times when, without doubt, you and I know that we've been used by God. I just want to say that that doesn't necessarily mean that we are therefore righteous or going to be accepted by God in the last day. I give you a couple of examples of where it seems to me that some of the judges in this chapter were not necessarily so righteous. You read about the large numbers of children which they had. You take verse 9. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters. Well, pretty obviously, the guy was a polygamist. He didn't have one wife who produced 30 sons and 30 daughters, surely. He sent his daughters away in marriage, that is, to the Gentiles, and brought in 30 women for his sons. Well, to marry those outside the covenant was not right, quite clearly. The AV says that he brought these in from abroad. The Mosaic intention was quite clearly that they should keep the inheritance within their tribes, and there was specific legislation about that. So by marrying people from outside the tribe, let alone from outside Israel, this was clearly not what God intended. And yet, these judges were used by God. You take Abdon in verse 14. He had 40 sons. Well, again, it's quite clear that he must have been a polygamist to have 40 sons, and how many daughters we don't know. And, all right, polygamy is not per se condemned, but quite clearly this is, again, not God's ideal intention. Told in verse 15 that Abdon died and was buried in the hill country of the Amalekites. Well, clearly the Amalekites had not all been driven out of Israel, and the area where he was buried is still called the hill country of the Amalekites, the land of Ephraim. So Ephraim had still not driven out all the Amalekites at that time, even though Abdon had been the judge. So the progress that was made by the judges was very limited. Verse 11, Elon. Elon means grove of oaks, of oak trees. Well, a grove of oak trees is without question associated with idolatry. And he doesn't change his name, even if that is his birth name. There's plenty of examples in the scriptures of people changing their names. It was in fact common in Israelite culture and society to change your name, because you picked up a name that was appropriate to your behavior, to your character, to your history. And that's why a lot of the names that people are given are apparently so appropriate to their life experience. And you think, well, that's pretty freaky that their parents named them just how they were going to turn out. Well, not necessarily. They may have been named something, but then they renamed themselves, or were renamed, how they turned out, or according to later life experience, like somebody who was rather sickly might be given a name that might mean sickly or weak or something like that. Well, that's how they came to be known. And you look at Anglo-Saxon surnames. Smith was pretty clearly a person who worked as a smith, and he got known as Smith. The butler or whoever, baker, all these kind of names are very common. So quite clearly the same sort of thing happened in the earlier Anglo-Saxon period. Now, when you come to Jephthah, he is intentionally an enigma. We've discussed that when talking about chapter 11. I mean, did he kill his daughter or not? And I've suggested that I think the record is intentionally open-ended there to invite us to enter into the whole thing, to reflect on it, and to work out what we think might have happened. But you can't say dogmatically, you really can't. But I do wonder, I sort of veer possibly, although it's so open-ended, I don't know, I veer towards the idea that he set that up, just as Saul tried to set up the murder of his son Jonathan. I think the whole structure of the oath that he takes is so weird that he surely knew his daughter was going to come out, and he didn't have to do what he said. He could have, according to the legislation at the end of Leviticus, he could have offered a sacrifice and changed what he what he'd sanctified, let's say, unto God. But anyway, that being as it may, you do get here in chapter 12 the impression also that he did not particularly value human life. Look at verse 4. Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, "You Gileadites are renegades of Ephraim from Ephraim and Manasseh." Well, clearly the motivation for the conflict was racial and historical prejudice, not anything particularly spiritual. And you see here, I think, the power of unkind words. The Ephraimites had said, the Good News Bible said, "You Gileadites and Ephraim and Manasseh, you're deserters from Ephraim." And it seems that Jephthah and his people kept on and on reflecting on those words, just like people keep on playing the tape in their mind of something that's really upset them. And he really got to them. And instead of forgiving and moving on and thinking about something more spiritual, verse 5, the Gileadites took the fords of the River Jordan. And when the Ephraimites asked to cross over, the men of Gilead said to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if he said no, then they said to him, "Now say Shibboleth." And he said Sibboleth, because he couldn't manage to pronounce it right. And they seized him and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. Now, Sibboleth means both a stream, which is all the River Jordan is at times in some parts of northern Israel, some times of the year, or it can mean a burden of abuse. That's how it's used in Exodus 6. So the idea is, if they couldn't say Shibboleth, and they said Sibboleth, well, they were asking to have an abusive death. And I think the idea was that the men of Gilead were, in fact, very closely related to the Ephraimites. And what they're saying in verse 4 is the Ephraimites had said, "You people of Gilead are just renegades of us. You've gone off from us. We are the superior people in this tribe." And the people of Gilead were saying, "No, don't you dare say that we're inferior to you. You know, Jephthah's just won a great battle. How dare you say that?" So this was a battle between brethren. And then you read in verse 6 that 42,000 men of Ephraim fell. This was an absolute bloodbath. 42,000 of your brethren being killed one by one because he can't pronounce a word in a certain way because he's got a slight accent. Well, this is a major sin. I mean, if this were to happen today, people would say, yeah, guilty of genocide, life in jail or death penalty, guilty of absolute genocide, mass genocide against your own brethren. Now, that is what Jephthah was guilty of. And you do wonder, such a bloodthirsty kind of guy, whether he did set his own daughter up. And you sort of scratch your head a bit about this, but then you come to Hebrews 11, and Jephthah is listed amongst the faithful and those assured of salvation. Well, there was, I think, a period towards the end of his life when maybe he did repent. Whether that is the case or not, we don't know, but we might be able to assume that. But the fact is that he sinned terribly, and yet he's listed as a man of faith and someone assured of being in the kingdom. Now, I began by saying that these judges all had elements of weakness in them, and yet they were used by God. Well, when you try to put together, you know, was Jephthah a good guy or a bad guy? Well, you know, the final judgment is good guy because he's going to be in the kingdom. But Not necessarily was he a sort of good believer throughout his life. He was saved by his faith. And you go through those people in Hebrews 11, you've got people like Samson. Well, he didn't live a great life spiritually, not at all, and yet was saved by faith. So you see the huge importance that faith or trust in God really has, that is of the absolute essence, that you trust in him, especially that you trust in him for your final salvation. That's what's important. I'm not saying that living a good and spiritual life is therefore unimportant, and that it's okay to live how Samson lived or carry on how Jephthah carried on at this point, killing 42,000 of his own brethren. No, of course it's not okay. I don't wish to imply that. But what I'm saying is that despite all that, God looks through a lot of this stuff, the ups and downs of spiritual life. You did fantastically at this point, you did awfully at that point. God sees through all that, those extreme markers, as it were, on the graph, those points and those, you know, peaks and valleys. He sees through that. What he's interested in is faith. Not the stellar acts of obedience and faith or commitment, let's say, nor the stellar acts of failure, of which Samson had many, and seems to me Jephthah had a few as well. And this one we just read about, killing 42,000 of his brethren over a matter of words that just got to him and bugged him. It's a pretty stellar example of serious failure. And yet he's going to be saved. Because despite such major and dramatic ups and downs, he had that trust in God in the end, and trust in God's salvation, and trust in God's grace. So I hope that helps us see not only our own ups and downs of faith and behaviour in more context, but I hope it also helps us to see others' ups and downs of faith and behaviour in some context as well, because somebody has done amazing things at one point in their life, or in some aspects of their life, is really quite committed and amazing. It does not necessarily mean anything in God's book. It depends on their basic core trust in God. And the fact, likewise, that people have committed stellar failures, which we all tend to focus on, that, oh, do you know what, she did this, do you know what, he did that. Well, yeah, he did, or she did, but that's not quite the point. As you see from all this, God alone will judge, not according to the highest points and low points of somebody's life, but according to their basic core faith and abiding trust in him.